Summer's hotter weather is finally here, but don't let hair loss also make you sweat. Regrow hair with help from Hims. They provide access to personalized treatment so you can see thicker, fuller hair in just 3 to 6 months. Get started from the comfort of home. Fill out an intake form and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
You're listening to the Common Fan Podcast, a Husker football podcast for the common fan by the common fan.
Welcome back to the Common Fan Podcast. I am TJ Burkle, as always, alongside Maddie Owens Sr. and Geoff in Lincoln. Hey, get to the Common Fan website, www.commonfan.co. You can sign up for the free newsletter, follow all the social media accounts, subscribe on YouTube, and of course, get your Common Fan socks. You can get those from the Common Fan website, or you can go to silliesco.com, S-I-L-L-I-E-S-C-O. .com. Use the promo code GBR for life. That's GBR number 4 LIFE. And get all the socks on the Sillies Co. site. They've got Common Fan socks. They've got all kinds of other colorful, fun socks as well. Check it out at silliesco.com. This is episode 2 of TO, a series focused on the coaching career of the great Tom Osborne. In episode 1, we talked to Henry Cordes and Brandon Vogel about Coach Osborne's time as an assistant to Bob Devaney in the 1960s. We discussed his early days straddling graduate school and coaching football, his fateful promotion to offensive coordinator in 1968, and the famous conversation on the bus ride back from Manhattan, Kansas, when Devaney first raised the idea of Osborne succeeding him as head coach. For today's episode, The Head Man, we'll focus on T.O.'s early days as the head coach in Lincoln, starting from when he took over in 1973 through the remainder of the 1970s. We're thrilled to be joined today by some very distinguished guests. Tom Rude played at Nebraska from 1971 to 1974. He was the co-Big 8 Athlete of the Year in 1974 and was also first-team All-Big 8 that year when he led the team in tackles and was subsequently drafted in the first round of the NFL draft by the Buffalo Bills. He is a 1997 inductee to the Nebraska Football Hall of Fame. Mike Babcock has covered Nebraska football for decades for the Lincoln Journal Star and Huskers Illustrated, among others. He is also the author of numerous books about Nebraska football, including Tom Osborne on Leadership. Special guest Brandon Vogel is joining us once again as well. Brandon runs the Counter Read newsletter, some of the best Husker content out there. Check out counterread.com for all his great work. Gentlemen, it's great to have you joining the Common Fans today.
Thanks for having us.
Mr. Root, I've got to say to you, it feels so for the Common Fan viewers and listeners who don't know, Matt, Geoff, and I all grew up in Lincoln, all the same high school graduating class as Barrett, your son. And so we, you know, would play against him over the years, usually losing to whatever team he was on, I feel like. But it feels a little bit odd to call you Tom. It feels like we should be calling you Mr. Rude, but for the purposes of
I hope
it's okay if we call you Tom.
Works very good. So, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Side note, just curious if you ever found like Barrett pacing around the house, you know, really nervous about an upcoming game against Pius or anything like that? Just curious if he, you know.
I don't recall him being too nervous with the Pius games at all. But, he hit that pretty good. So.
Well, yeah, he was probably thinking it. That's probably it. All right, well, let's jump right in. And Tom, I'd like to start with you. So you graduated from high school in Minnesota. You come to Nebraska. You're a freshman in 1971 as Devaney is winning his second consecutive national title. Back in those days, freshmen couldn't play on the varsity. But then in 1972, your first year on the varsity, the Huskers still go 9-2-1. That included a 17-14 loss to then number 4 Oklahoma. But overall, Nebraska finishes second in the Big 8. They finish in the top 10 nationally. You dismantled Notre Dame in the Orange Bowl. And Johnny Rogers wins the Heisman. So I would imagine the vibes around the program are still pretty good. And then Devaney announces he's retiring and Tom Osborne is taking over as the head coach. I'm just kind of curious for you and your experience. You're 2 years into the program. It's kind of at the top of the college football mountaintop. And then suddenly the guy who you came to play for is retiring and Tom Osborne is taking over. What was that like for you? Or what, like, was that nerve-wracking or was it just kind of business as usual? Or what was going through your head at that time?
I think it was a pretty emotional time for all of us because they're, with Coach Devaney, he was, real different personality than Tom Osborne was. And, being recruited by Devaney, we all kind of expected him to be around or whatever. Obviously, we respected Coach Osborne for what he, did with the program offensively. We, on the defensive side, we really didn't like the offense anyhow. You're beating each other up every day in practice. We really didn't care for him, and he was an offensive coach and whatever. But that's part of college football, is you want to be the best, and a change was difficult for a lot of us. Not that Coach Osborne wasn't a great coach, but Coach Devaney was the real deal, and that's why all of us came to play for him. So.
Tom, what was, Devaney and Tom, pretty different personalities. A lot of these guys come in, they get used to a coach like Devaney. I'm sure they all, knew Coach Osborne, being on the coaching staff. But was there kind of a difference in the locker room? I guess, Devaney was kind of a boisterous guy, life of the party kind of guy. And, I wasn't born yet, but I know that Tom Osborne is more stoic and he's just, there's different personalities. Was there kind of a difference? What was the mood in the locker room with the players? Is there kind of a different vibe, I guess, with, you got one guy going out that's kind of got one personality, a new guy coming in that's got a different personality. What was it like, I guess, the mood amongst you and your teammates?
Well, I think that's the hardest question all of us were trying to figure out is, how much is this going to change? Because Coach Devaney would cuss you up and down and tell you he was going to send you back on a bus if you ever did that again. And Coach Osborne, would be Jiminy Crickets, being cussed up and down versus Jiminy Crickets. Some of us had a little more trouble, coming to grips with how we're being coached and managed, but there was still respect. Coach Osborne showed that he, was trying to do the best for us. And, we all wanted to, we didn't want to lose a game. We came here to not lose games. And we never got that done in my years. We always lost one or two. But you came here to win national championships, and And, you know, I'm proud of what we did, but, you know, didn't get it done, kind of how we looked at it. So,
yeah, sure.
I'm curious. I know Jeff's got a question, but I want to jump in for Tom one more. Was there any sense of wondering? So Osborne and Monty Kiffin had been elevated as offensive and defensive coordinators in the same year, a few years before you got there. Was there any sense among your defensive teammates of like, well, wait, why didn't Monty get the job instead of Tom?
Oh, I'm not sure that we really questioned that too much. Obviously, you know, Monty was on the side of the ball that we were on, and that's the, you know, the coach that, you know, was running our defense. But, you know, we really didn't go there too much. But there was a contingent that was wondering, you know, why. You know, why him versus, and, you know, Bob Devaney was a pretty sharp guy. I think he knew that Tom Osborne was pretty special in his knowledge of football and what he thought he could do. So,
love it. Mike, Brandon, I want to get you folks involved as well. I'm kind of curious. We've gone through it a lot now, obviously, as Husker football fans with constant coaching changes. And I'm kind of curious about what the expectations were for T.O. when he took over. We're all Common fans, especially you two, since you've joined us multiple times now on the show. And we know how Husker fans can get once we've tasted that championship, since once we've been to the top of that mountain, right? We want more. It's an addiction. Every time we hire a new coach, it's always, give it a couple years and we're going to be right back to where we were and we're going to have a well-oiled machine. Never seems to turn out that way. So I guess I'm curious, for back then, coming from off of Devaney and the success that he had, what were the expectations for Tom Osborne? Were they thinking that he's just going to pick up where Devaney left off and keep rolling? Or were there some worries that maybe this wasn't going to work or not stay on track? Mike, you want to go first?
I'd rather Brandon go first, then I can agree with him. And. you know, I think that the expectations were there because of the, you know, the two national championships that Bob had won in 70 to 71. You know, one of the reasons he stayed in 72 at one point, he was considering retiring after 71. And in fact, Tom had even brought in Jerry Moore from SMU as a receivers coach and then had to tell him, well, it's going to be delayed a year before we start. And Hayden Fry was the head coach at SMU, and he let Jerry Moore come back for another season. But I think the expectations were still there. And you look at the success that Osborne had. People didn't see it that way because it didn't end up in national championships.
Right.
But, you know, a couple of those seasons, Nebraska got ranked as high as number two. Part of the problem was you're in the same conference with Oklahoma, and there was talent left over from, 70. Barry. So I had.
Mike, you're kind of breaking up there a little bit. Brandon, you want to jump
Brandon,
in?
Hop on in there.
You're muted, Brandon.
There we go. Sorry about that. Yeah, I can try and pick up a little bit there. I wasn't around for that era to experience expectations firsthand, but I do consider myself kind of a student of college football and a
history.
It'll probably come up later. In a lot of ways, I see a lot of kind of parallels between Ryan Day taking over at Ohio State and what happened with Coach Osborne. And I would say, you know, in the same way that if Dabo Swinney leaves Clemson, expectations aren't immediately going to decrease of like, okay, he built, you know, Clemson into a national title caliber program. And you don't want to go back from that. So based on the research that I've done and, you know, reading contemporaneous accounts from that time, like I think to kind of what Mike was going, the expectation was Nebraska had just won two national titles. And not only that, like it was kind of Nebraska had been good at football for a very long time, but those were its first two national titles. So it had just kind of entered the club. And now, you know, the guy who got Nebraska there and Coach Devaney decides to step aside. You kind of don't want to start with, well, maybe just kind of be in a, you know, 8-3 type program is like the natural state. Like you want to dream, anything's possible.
Yeah. It looks like Mike is back with us. Anything you want to add there, Mike? We kind of lost you at the end of your answer.
Yeah, I had some great insights when I was lost. No, as I said, I just think that the expectations were in part based on those two national championships. And the difficulty was you're in the same conference with Oklahoma. And in order to be successful in the conference, you had to beat Oklahoma. That was the thing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just Nebraska with anybody in the conference, but it basically came down to Nebraska and Oklahoma more often than not. And Nebraska had those problems. Also had some problems with Missouri early on.
Yeah,
I don't think beat Missouri in Lincoln until 1980. And wow. I think Tom was 3-4 against Missouri in the 70s.
Mm. Tom, anything to add to that from the player's perspective? It sounds like from what you said earlier, hey, as a player, you're still expecting to win. You came to the best, you know, the best program in the country. You wanted to win national titles. But anything from the player perspective to add about sort of the expectations around Coach Osborne when he took over?
Well, I don't think it was any different. You know, recruiting wise, we came to Nebraska to win national championships. And, you know, they obviously, and when I was in high school, they were coming off a national championship and, you know, it was thought of that, you were expected to bring more of them back. And, you know, and I still believe that we had enough talent at times to do it, but putting it together, offense and defense, was difficult, and I'm still disappointed that we didn't, you know, do better than we did. You know, losing 2 or 3 games—that's too many if you were coming to Nebraska to win national championship. So,
yeah. Okay, so Osborne takes over in 1973. And the next several years, I'll just tick through it really quickly. 73, they go 9-2-1, lose to Oklahoma 27-0, and then beat Texas in the Cotton. 1974, the Huskers go 9-3, lose to Oklahoma 28-14, beat Florida in the Sugar Bowl. 1975, Nebraska goes 10-2, lose to Oklahoma 35-10, then lost, went to the Fiesta Bowl, played Arizona State. But lost in the Fiesta Bowl. Interesting, going into that Oklahoma game in 75, they were ranked number 2 in the country. 76, they go 9-3-1, lose to Oklahoma in a heartbreaker. They lose 2017, beat Texas Tech in the Blue Bonnet Bowl. 1977, they go 9-3, lose to Oklahoma 38-7, and beat North Carolina in the Liberty Bowl. So Osborne's first 5 years, he goes 46-13-2. Of course, back in those days, there was no overtime, so there were ties occasionally. Shared the Big 8 title in 1975. In the top 10 of at least one of the AP or the coaches poll in most years in both. Had a hard time beating Oklahoma. And as you alluded to, Mike, in those through 77, they lost to Missouri in 73, 74, and 76. I'm curious. So when we grew up, you know, those memories start late 80s, early 90s of paying attention to Nebraska football. And certainly the narrative of T.O. not being able to win the big one was alive and well, you know, of course, before he got over the hump in 1994. But was that already starting to take hold? Because these were some really dang good teams. And, you know, Husker fans today looking at those results would be thrilled with some
I was just going to say, looking at that resume there, TJ, like that's something someone would step over their own grandmother to achieve now in Husker Nation.
Right. But of course, they couldn't get the Oklahoma monkey off their back. So, Mike, maybe I'll start with you. Is that, you know, was there a disproportionate effect, I guess, of losing to Oklahoma? Was that the big one that they that Osborne couldn't win? And was that narrative starting to take effect already, take hold already?
Well, yeah, no question about that. But, you know, you have to consider Oklahoma won national championships in 74 and 75. I mean, that was a dominant program. I think Switzer, and that was the other thing, that Switzer and Osborne became head coaches at the same time. 1973, and if you look at Tom's record against Switzer in the 70s, it was 1-7. You know, so people are getting upset about that. And Brandon may know this better than I do, but after one of the bowl games in the mid 70s, coming back from the bowl game, there was a story about one of the regents said it was a good thing you won that bowl game because if you hadn't, .. You know, that there was that kind of concern because they couldn't beat Oklahoma. That's what seemed to screw up everything. You know, and even when you finally did beat Oklahoma in 78, you turn around and had to play them in a bowl game in the Orange Bowl, and you lost to them. And, you know, in his book, Bootlegger's Boy, Barry Switzer says that the 78 team may have been his best. You know, so look at that. Nebraska beats team, and then you have to play them again. Playing a team twice is not easy, especially a team of the caliber there. But people are looking at it and saying, you know, why can't they get this done? So Tom interviews with Colorado, and probably could have had the job, but decided that, hey, I can't. When he and Nancy went out there to Boulder, and as he's talking to the team, he's thinking, hey, I can't coach guys against guys that I recruited at Nebraska. I can't do that. And he turned that job down, even though it would have, I think, tripled his salary.
Jeez.
And he decided to stay at Nebraska. But part of that was just the frustration that the fans had that they couldn't beat Oklahoma. That was the big thing. They couldn't beat Oklahoma.
Yeah.
No. And then you do beat Oklahoma and you're in a position to play for a national title and you lose to Missouri.
Yeah. We'll get to all that. Brandon, anything to add to sort of the to the original question?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Oklahoma thing, it's kind of the curse of being really, really good. We saw this during the Bo Pelini era of like, okay, yeah, like pencil you in for 9-4, but like, what else? What else is there? And, you know, during that time, like it was, well, can you beat Oklahoma? And Coach Osborne obviously starts out 0-5 against them over his first five seasons. But I think that the thing that often gets overlooked with that is like the Big Eight was pretty deep at this point. So from 73 to 79, so the 70s, with Osborne as head coach, Nebraska played, in 73 alone, they played seven top 20 teams. Imagine that. In an 11-game regular season, they played seven top 20 teams, including wow. Top 10 wow. UCLA and top 10 NC State to open the year. But over that stretch, like Kansas was top 20 at a point when Nebraska played them. Iowa State, Oklahoma State, Colorado, the only Big Ten or Big Eight school that wasn't in the top 20 during that 73 to 79 was Kansas State. And, you know, we kind of know what they were pre Bill Snyder. So some of it becomes like, okay, Oklahoma's the last game of the year. It's obviously a rival. It's really important. I think the thing that gets overlooked is just how well Nebraska was doing against other really good teams. 17-12 was Osborne's record over those 7 years against ranked opponents. And there's only seven coaches over the past 7 years of college football. So in our current era, who have better winning percentage against ranked opponents there? Those are toss-up games. They're tough.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Tom, I know you said there's still some disappointment for not winning the national championship. It sounds like you beat some pretty dang good teams while you were there.
Yeah. But, you know, it kind of like you talked about, you know, there was a lot of really good teams, and we expected to beat them. You know, Bob Devaney, you know, his whole deal, and Ozzie took it over is, you know, we thought we should win every game. Now, Oklahoma, I wouldn't ever have said it at that time. They actually had a better team overall, offense, defense, special teams, whatever. And, Barry Switzer had a way of, for some reason, getting a lot of those Texas kids to come up there. And I don't know if it has anything to do with the price of oil, but, you know, they did really well during that period of time. So.
There was probably some I'm not going to make any accusations here, any unfounded accusations, but you know that Barry kind of liked to be a little flashy with the mink coats and everything. And who knows how he could have got some of those players back.
Barry's basically said over the years, some of the rules he sort of were more suggestions for him.
You're saying Barry had NIL before there was NIL? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, Barry introduced NIL to college football. He kept up with the Southern schools. So.
Brandon, first of all, always bringing the numbers and the stats. I love it. Good job. Mike, I do have something I wanted to send your way. You kind of alluded to it before, and I wanted to circle back about Oklahoma. They were an awesome team back then, really, really good. Tom just said he thought they were better than Nebraska or had a better team than Nebraska, and we were good. So I guess with Osborne losing to Oklahoma, he says in his book that he didn't really panic or get uptight about the whole situation as people might have thought. And of course, he's probably going to say that. But the belief of many is that he became obsessed, for lack of a better word, with beating Oklahoma, and it drove him to be better and better. So, Mike, I guess I was just curious, what are your thoughts on that? Is that something he was obsessing over and just, this is my goal now. I have to beat this team.
Well, I think that may have been in the background, but Tom was a one game at a time type guy. I mean, he was very, I remember a story, I think it might have been a little later than the 70s, but it reflected how Tom approached things. I was working at the Journal Star, and you could just walk down 10th Street to the stadium, and you crossed 10th Street, and then you crossed Q Street, and then you walked on down. And I was going one day to practice and before practice, and Nebraska was playing somebody that week that they were going to end up beating, hammering, and so I'm standing on the corner and the light changes, starting to change, and so instead of going across, I go diagonal through the intersection because Tom is waiting for the light to change, and he yells at me, "Hey, Mike, you want a ride?" And I didn't want him to, you know, be stuck with cars coming. So I went across the intersection, and just as I got in front of the car, I slid on rocks, and I fell down in front of his car. It happened in an instant, you know, and I wanted to get up and say, "That's okay, coach, I'll walk." But, obviously I couldn't stay. So I get in and I just stare straight ahead, and he doesn't say anything until we get ready to turn into the parking lot in the South Stadium. And he says, "Mike, I don't think the team has taken Iowa State seriously this week. Do you?" And that's all he said. And when he pulled in, I got out and ran in sports information office, one of the sports, Steve Peterson was working in the state in the sports information office, and I told him a story. He said, what you need to do now is when you go out to post practice today, when you go up to Coach Osborne, slide and fall down like Chevy Chase. So he thinks it's intentional. But the point is, I think Tom was very focused week to week. Whoever they were playing, that's who he was focused on. But he did get to the point where they worked on the wishbone one day a week. You know, they took time to work on that because that was an Oklahoma thing. So that you didn't see that offense until you played Oklahoma, basically. So he worked on, he did it once a week to prepare for that thing. So there was evidence that how important that was. And the other thing is that Tom wasn't resistant to change. He got in his mind that the way to be successful against Oklahoma was to play the way Oklahoma played. And so the first sort of running quarterback he recruited in 76 was Jeff Quinn. And in 79, he recruited Nate Mason because he was starting to change his mentality on what the offense ought to look like. And it was the reason for the change was Oklahoma. That's the way Oklahoma played. And, you know, he was, I think from that standpoint, he was very focused on Oklahoma. But during the season, from week to week, it was whoever they were playing next. It had to be the focus, and you had to treat them as if they're, in many cases, better than they were, so that you could get the job.
Well, that's a pretty good segue into my next question, Mike. And I want to direct this more towards Brandon. I know Brandon's a student of the history of college football, and he's into these types of things. But about the offense, you know, I think for a lot of us, I'm going to say we're younger on this panel, but a lot of people associate Tom Osborne and his teams with the option. But I know that didn't start until a little bit later on, like Mike just said. You know, realizing we have to have an athletic quarterback and we have to maybe run something like the wishbone or some type of running offense. Is that late 70s? Is that kind of when that kind of happened? And then also, what was the offense like? Was it more pro style before that they switched more to an option attack? You got some thoughts and some, I'm sure you got some great thoughts and some great analytics or something on this, Brandon.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, when Coach Osborne was made the offensive coordinator with like no fanfare compared to what hiring a coordinator would be today, you know, he was taking Nebraska from kind of the Devaney era offense of, you know, full house backfield, stacked line, like real run heavy, to an I formation that, you know, was willing to throw the ball a little bit. And you could see in those years after kind of the uptick in passing for Nebraska. Not that they were like, you know, Mike Leach air raid or anything like that, but for the time, like, it was pretty balanced from a numbers perspective. And, you know, kind of, we talked about this in a previous episode. At that point, when Osborne takes over as offensive coordinator, kind of like the real option era of college football at the top level in terms of like the top teams running it is coming. Houston's running the veer. Oklahoma and Texas are about to like do crazy things with the wishbone. And so you get to kind of the late 70s with Coach Osborne, and he keeps the I formation. It's kind of one of his big innovations, but starts to run some option concepts out of that.
Summer's hotter weather is finally here, but don't let hair loss also make you sweat. Regrow hair with help from Hims. They provide access to personalized treatment so you can see thicker, fuller hair in just 3 to 6 months. Get started from the comfort of home. Fill out an intake form and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
And I think it speaks to his practicality. I think it speaks to his adaptability. To Mike's point, they started practicing, you know, against the Wishbone, which, like, you can't overstate that. That thing that they ran like wildfire over college football. And if you had Oklahoma talent or Texas talent, like, you could run it really, really well. You know, Colorado tried to run the Wishbone for a while, Mississippi State, et cetera. You get to those late 80s and Jeff Quinn, quarterback from Ord, who had some of those traits. And by the time you get to that 1980 Cotton Bowl against Houston, like, you can pull that game up. It's one of the best games to pull up on YouTube. Houston had a live baby cougar on the sideline, which is just amusing to me. But you start to see it. Like, Nebraska's not running a ton of option in that game, but it's running some. And, you know, the impetus was like, look what some of these other teams are doing with that type of attack.
Tom, I saw you reacting there at the original question, and you practiced against the offense in 73 and 74. And then, of course, your brother played on those late 70s teams. Anything to add to that, or any thoughts on what you saw of the offense evolving over that time?
Yeah, the interesting thing with Nebraska's offense, and you hit it on it, that, you know, Coach Osborne went from a run heavy to, you know, the I formation, and, you know, he did run a spread formation, so he had the passing game to go along with it. And again, he was way ahead of his time in making it difficult for a defense to plan against what he was going to do, and that kind of signaled how far advanced he was in offensive play calling, and that he was ahead of the game, and that the hardest thing for a defense to do is not know if you're going to run or pass, because you know, what you line up and what you can do. And Ozzy was really good at game planning, and he did a really, really good job of that.
Awesome. Okay, so 1978, Mike hinted at some of these things. 1978 proves to be a pivotal year. The Huskers lose to Alabama to open the year, and then they run off 9 straight wins, including finally beating Oklahoma. We'll come back to that. The very next week, they lose to unranked Missouri at home, 35-31. They're still Big 8 champs, and in the locker room after the Missouri game, they get their invitation to play in the Orange Bowl. Their opponent is none other than the Oklahoma Sooners, as Mike mentioned, who Osborne had just beat for his first time as head coach. And of course, the Huskers would go on to lose that Orange Bowl 31-24. There's a lot to unpack here, and I want to focus first on the big win over Oklahoma and finally getting the Oklahoma monkey off the back. But before I do that, I want to read this blurb from Coach Osborne's book, More Than Winning. when he talks about finding out that they had to play Oklahoma a second time in a matter of weeks. What a blow. Losing to Missouri and learning that we would have to play Oklahoma twice within a period of 7 weeks, particularly after finally having beaten them for the first time in 7 years, put me as low as I've ever been in coaching. And then a little later, he goes on to say, there were two times in those first 6 years when I wanted to chuck it all. The first was in 1976 when we let Oklahoma off the hook in the final moments of the game with two long passing plays, lost 20-17. This was the second time. So clearly that was like, clearly a blow to have to play, to find out they had to play Oklahoma a second time after finally beating them, finally getting the monkey off their back. So I just wanted to share that up front. We'll come back to that. First, that game against Oklahoma when they finally win. Early in the fourth quarter, the Huskers kick a field goal to take a 17-14 lead. On the ensuing kickoff, your brother Tom John Rood forces a fumble. The Huskers recover, and yet the officials give Oklahoma the ball. Now, of course, this is before the days of replay, and you couldn't overturn a call. Obviously, an early indication that the college football industrial complex has been out to get Nebraska for a long time. We all know that. Tom or Mike, do you guys remember this moment? Did it feel like the Huskers would be snake bit again, or did it start to get that sinking feeling of oh my gosh, like here we go again, when Oklahoma got the ball back and then they started to drive down the field?
Mike, you go ahead. I'll finish up with a story about my brother's head after.
Yeah, Kelly Phelps didn't get up from that very well, to say the least. You know, I think there was probably a little bit of that, you know, when you're watching that, because of what's happened to that point. You haven't beaten Oklahoma, and here's this Oklahoma team that's number one at that point. Sure, you know, give them another opportunity. Even though they fumbled nine times in that game and you recovered six. And fortunately, the sixth recovery was, I mean, they were going down. They were going to score. And, you get that sixth fumble and you recover it with not much time left. And I still got a picture on the wall here of everybody celebrating after recovering that fumble. But, you know, going back to the Phelps hit, yeah. You think, well, here we go, you know, doggone, Sooners are going to figure something out. We didn't have Sooner magic yet. We didn't have that term, but it was an element there. People had that sense and nobody just had thrown the term out yet. Yeah.
Tom, go ahead.
Well, I'm watching the game. I'm in Cincinnati playing for the Bengals in and watching the game by myself, you know, in my living room, and you know, I know my brother's on the special team, so I'm watching the us kick off, and all of a sudden I see the missile hit the kid from Oklahoma, and the ball, you know, went. And I said, I thought my brother probably killed himself the way he hit the kid or whatever. And he's chasing the ball. And I said, oh, he's okay then. And I said to him, what'd the ref say? And I said, and he goes, he said, hey, I thought you killed the kid. I blew the whistle, you know, so the kid was dead. So that's what the ref told him on the field.
Wow. Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's awesome. Brandon, anything to add to that one or anything relating to that game?
No, not specifically. You know, the one, not all that amusing anecdote, but that 79 Orange Bowl that followed against Oklahoma, it was technically my first Nebraska game. I was in utero, but my parents did make that trip to Miami, so I was there, kind of.
There you go.
That's incredibly interesting.
Tom, TJ mentioned it before. He said college football industrial complex. Just for your reference, and you know, we have a theory out there that there's almost like a new world order, a group, a shadow ban against the Nebraska Cornhuskers that they're always trying to keep us down and not let us win again. So when TJ mentioned that, that's what he's referring to, which kind of brings me to almost, I don't want to say a question, but a thought here. I mean, break this down here. You think about it. You finally beat Oklahoma, right? And then you turn around and lose to an unranked Missouri team right after that. And then you find out that you have to play Oklahoma again in the bowl game after the fact. I mean, if that isn't something that would only happen to the Nebraska Cornhuskers back then and even now, I don't know what is. I mean, that's nuts. So I guess really, mentality-wise, like what happened there with that Missouri game? Is that like a hangover from your big victory after the fact? Or just how does that really work? I can't wrap my head around how you can go off of one of your biggest games ever to turn it around and having one of the biggest upsets after that. I mean, Tom, if you want to jump in on that, or if Mike or Brandon, any one of you want to give your thoughts.
I think there was a little bit of a letdown from the Oklahoma game, but you know, it started out, Rick Burns went 89 yards for touchdown on the first play from scrimmage. It's like, well, here it go. You know, this is going to be a blowout. But James Wilder and Phil Bradley had other ideas about how that was going to come out. That was a good Missouri team. It wasn't ranked, but you know, Wilder and Bradley were a tough combination, and Wilder ran wild that day. But again, you thought the way it started, you thought, wow, the Huskers were ready for this one. Missouri better look out. And, you know, as I said earlier, I don't think Nebraska beat Missouri at home in the 70s. It was just, you know, there was another frustration for you.
And that's crazy to hear too, because I remember there was a stretch of like 20 some years in a row where Nebraska didn't lose to Missouri. So it must have started soon after that.
Yeah. It did. It got to the point where a lot of those games were lopsided Nebraska victories, but early on it was a problem. And I think it was it 77? Nebraska opened with a loss against Washington State. Warren Powers was the coach there. And then in 78, Warren Powers was the coach at Missouri. And so there was some frustration there as well, because Warren Powers had been on the Husker staff, had actually been on Osborne's staff, and fans were not happy about that whole situation either. Yeah. Even though my uncle was equipment manager at Nebraska through 77, I think, from 68 to 77 or somewhere in there, 65. And he was from the North Loop, Scotia area, known for its popcorn. And so he would always bring popcorn.
That would be Gibb.
Yeah. And he'd bring popcorn down for Warren Powers. When Powers came in, there was a coach because they had a connection even when after that. But I think that was very frustrating. Obviously, that loss, but I think that there was some letdown emotionally after that tremendous win against Oklahoma.
Yeah,
finally got the job done, and then here comes a team that you haven't had a lot of success against early on, and you come away 35-31 loser, I think. Yeah.
So what was the perception of coach at that time then? Because it was kind of the, you know, couldn't beat Oklahoma, couldn't win the big one kind of thing going. And then he does win the big one and beats Oklahoma and then turns around and loses Mizzou and plays OU again and loses. What was the perception of him amongst the fans and all that with, you know, he won the big one, but then they turn around and lost a couple. So what are people thinking at that time? Is that kind of lead us into when he's exploring leaving and going to see you?
I think that's an element of it, obviously, because of the timing of the situation. I think that, you know, he wanted to look for something else, maybe less, there'd be less pressure. at Colorado, for example, than there was at Nebraska. And you looked into it, and like I said, he got to the point where he and Nancy went out. Well, they always flew separately, you know, because of the kids, but they went out, and he's speaking to the team, and he comes to the realization that, hey, I can't coach guys that I recruited at Nebraska. I can't coach against them here. You know, I made a commitment to those guys. And so we found out about it at the newspaper by phone from Kansas City, because Tom immediately left that Colorado and flew to Kansas City because he was on a recruiting mission. I mean, that's the way he was. It's like, I decided I'm not going to do this. I got to get to recruiting, and off he went. So that's how we found out by phone that he had decided to stay at Nebraska. And there was a significant difference in what he would have gotten paid at Colorado had he decided to do that. And ironically, who did Colorado hire but Chuck Fairbanks? So.
Well, and it's interesting. So he says in his book, More Than Winning, in the 24 years, at this time he wrote this book in, you know, before he was done coaching. So at the time he wrote the book, it was said, in the 24 years I've been at the University of Nebraska, the only time I seriously contemplated leaving was after the 1978 season. And he outlined his reasons for staying, which is mainly the players. I think Nebraska's facilities were better. And he also talks about kind of a renewed appreciation for the fan base. I think they had been looking at it as a little bit of a burden, the high expectations. They felt like they had been pretty good. Maybe the fans weren't appreciative. And I think once we went to Colorado, we realized, hey, we've got like a unified fan base here. There's no pro team competing for our support. Like, I think you realize, hey, we've got a pretty good thing going at Nebraska, and decided to stay there. But I'll just put this to the group. I'd love all three, Mike, Tom, and Brandon, I'd love to get your perspective on this. But needless to say, Tom Osborne leaving Lincoln for Boulder after 1978 would have drastically altered the history of Nebraska football, Big Eight football, and likely the national college football scene. And anybody want to react to that?
Yes. Yes, I think it would happen. I think it would have been a significant thing. I don't know. It would have been significant, and I'm not saying that, okay, and then all of a sudden Colorado charges to the front and there you go. But I just felt like Osborne was in a good position here at Nebraska because he established the walk-on program. You know, that was really important to what he did. He had the strength and conditioning program, which was state-of-the-art and kind of ahead of its time. And academically, he had Ursula Laws. He emphasized that as well. And I think that, you know, I don't know that you could have transferred all that to Colorado with the additional thing of what you just pointed out. You had the sellout streak at Memorial Stadium. The passion of the fans could put pressure on him on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's a positive because look at the energy at the stadium when you're playing there. So I thought it would have changed college football from the standpoint of, I don't know where Nebraska would have been, and I don't think that Colorado would have suddenly leaped to the top of the bunch, but there would have been less pressure on him there. I think he realized that.
Tom, would that have been painful for you after beating up on Colorado during your time at Nebraska, then seeing him pacing the sideline in Boulder?
You know, I can't even imagine it. I don't think that Tom would have done very good in Boulder. Just not that he couldn't coach, but everything else about it was not what he would like to be around. It's a different environment up there, and you know, the Boulder is a beautiful place, and you know, I was recruited there, and I had a beautiful gal that introduced me to when I was out there, and And I just said, I don't want to come here because I wouldn't be able to concentrate on getting an education and playing ball. There's a lot of stuff to do out there that wasn't football related.
The co-eds in Boulder couldn't pull you there, huh, Tom?
Yeah. No, they couldn't. They actually was smart enough to say, hey, I better stay away from here. So
good man.
We're glad you did.
Yeah.
Glad you did. Got more Grateful Dead records in your collection.
Hey,
there you go, Mike.
Yeah. Was alive and well going at that time.
Yeah. I'm shocked to hear that Tom Osborne wouldn't be into the hippies and beatniks on Pearl Street.
Now, I don't think he'd do very well.
Water and oil.
Yeah.
Brandon, anything to add to that?
No, not really. I mean, it's kind of hard to fathom like what that would have done to the sport broadly. I mean, the earlier quote that you read, TJ, of Coach Osborne talking about just like how difficult hearing that, oh, you got Oklahoma again in this bowl game. Like, it kind of took me aback, you know, because we think of Tom Osborne of like very measured, very kind of like middle of the road, like don't tip your hand. And here he is in his own book. Like, it really, I think, underscores just like how difficult the Oklahoma thing was. And I think, you know, at least taking a look at the Colorado job is probably maybe the utmost reflection of that.
Yeah, TJ, just to jump in real quick, I'll tell you what, it would have completely drastically changed the landscape of college football. It would have been like if Biff Tannen would have won with the Sports Almanac and had that alternate Hill Valley timeline in 1985 and Back to the Future 2.
Wow.
Remember that?
That's a great Back to the Future reference.
Yeah. That's exactly what it would have been like. The world would have been in anarchy and chaos.
Wonderful chime in there, Jeff. Well, we're right at the end of the decade here. But something that gets lost here is that the 1979 team was pretty dang good. So right after Coach is kind of thinking about maybe, you know, I want to do something different. And they start off 10-0 in 79, including a win over Penn State. They end up losing to Oklahoma 17-14, so another close one against the Sooners. And then they lost the Cotton Bowl game against Houston that Brandon mentioned earlier with the baby Cougar on the sideline. But that team in 79 finished number 9 in the AP poll, number 7 in the coaches poll. I mean, this sounds like a dream to those of us Husker fans that, you know, have gone through the last 10 years or so. But after those highs and lows of 78 and T.O. flirting with leaving, not much of a drop off for the Big Red. Any three of you, Tom, Mike, or Brandon, want to chime in and give thoughts on that 79 season?
I think that the 79 season sort of reflected where Nebraska was headed in terms of its offense. And, you know, I think that the emergence in the 80s, they finally beat Oklahoma, what, 3 straight years with the scoring explosion team. But it reflected that change in the offense as reflected in the recruiting. You know, Nate Mason in 79, then Turner Gill gets recruited. And Turner Gill, I think, was reflected the turning point. You know, he could have been a drop back passer. He could have been an option quarterback. He was that athletic and that talented. And I think that that's where the change started to come. Where you started to see the change in Tom's approach offensively. And, you know, then you had Steve Taylor was a quarterback in that. Jerry Godowski had he redshirted in 1 year, which he didn't want to do, he would have had 2 great seasons. He had 1 really remarkable season. That's where the offense started to change. And I think 79 was probably a reflection of that because you did get some energy and you did beat Oklahoma in consecutive seasons. So I think that was important. But yeah, it's interesting. You lose to Oklahoma 17-14, then you lose to Houston 17-14 and into the 80s you go. Mm.
I guess to piggyback off of that, Mike, let's just say it's New Year's Day, 1980. The 79 season's over. The Huskers have just lost the Cotton Bowl, but generally speaking, T.O. has just run off seven seasons that Nebraska fans today will be completely happy with. So I guess my question is, or for all of you, is T.O. getting some love at this point? Are they starting to appreciate what he's doing? Is there any skepticism left, or are they appreciating what they have and liking where things are going?
Well, there was a period of time in there, and I don't know if that's the one or not, but I think that there was some association, you know, with Tom never quite getting enough there for a number of years, you know, and we look at it today, you know, this winning, you know, 8, 9, 10 games, and, you know, was it good enough, you know, and then, you know, getting into the 90s where Tom dominated and whatever, and looking at today, with what's going on, it's kind of ridiculous how anybody could question anything that was going on with Tom Osborne. But the Nebraska fans were spoiled in that, you know, hey, we didn't win a national championship, or, you know, we didn't win 10 or 11 games, whatever. So, I mean, the fans were a little spoiled during that time period, and there was a little reflection on that with the fan base.
Yeah, the national titles that Bob won really influenced the attitude of the fans. I think Bob was 5-6 against Oklahoma. I mean, he didn't have a winning record against Sooners either, but he got the national championships.
Right.
You know, that's the thing that sort of sealed it for him. And you know, so what are your expectations now at that time? Because Tom always, his team's always won at least 9 games and played in a bowl game. I mean, that's, but they hadn't won national championships. And people, because of those 2 national championships, that's what was in Husker fans' heads, you know.
Sure.
Why don't we do this? Why are we not winning these championships? Yeah, it's great.
Wait, Brandon, anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, it kind of just takes me back to, I mentioned it earlier, but like Ryan Day, and like where were things at with Ryan Day when Michigan beat Ohio State again this year? New playoff format means Ohio State can still get in, and they go on a run and they look like the best team in the country over the, you know, final 3 games of their season. But, you know, even without that, like Ryan Day is winning 85% of his games. He followed up somebody who won the national title at Ohio State, which is really, really hard to do. It's what Tom Osborne was trying to do at Nebraska. And like, it's just kind of human behavior, no matter if you're a fan of a team that's like naturally 6-6 or a team that's naturally 9-3, to be like, well, can we do better than that? Like, it's just, it's how it goes. And it's a tough profession for that reason.
One interesting note from the book, again, Jeff, sort of to, it's actually after he interviewed at Colorado in 78, Osborne says, the whole exercise proved to have some unexpected results. After looking at Colorado, I had a renewed appreciation for the positive features we have at the University of Nebraska. And when we appeared to be on our way to Colorado, the Nebraska fans showed a little greater appreciation for the accomplishments of our coaching staff and expressed the desire to see us stay. It was a turning point, end of quote. So that's kind of interesting. Maybe there's a little bit of a renewed appreciation. They're going into the 79 season and then after that as well. So, yeah. All right, gents. Well, that wraps up the discussion on sort of Osborne's first years as a head coach. Gets us through the 1970s. I want to give Tom the last word, but Mike or Brandon, any final thoughts, any big picture takeaways, anything else you want to add or thoughts on this whole discussion?
What Tom's about to say.
Yeah, Tom, I'm gonna let you go last. So Mike and Brandon, you go first. Yeah, okay. Mike, go ahead.
No, I don't have anything else to say. I'm like I said, I'll agree with whatever Tom has to say when he say, oh yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
I'll say, as somebody who wasn't around for all but the last 5 months of the decade, college football scheduling was really awesome. I mentioned that 73 team that played seven top 20 teams, opened with UCLA and NC State back-to-back weeks, had the Washington State game that Mike mentioned that was a loss. And then I think the next week, Nebraska came back and beat a ranked Alabama team. As I was going over the results, that was one thing that certainly jumped out to me of man, we would all lose our minds in today's media kind of world if Nebraska had some of these schedules.
Yeah, sure. You weren't seeing a lot of Akron or Houston Christian on those schedules back then.
No, you aren't.
Hey, we'll take the W's wherever we can get them this year, Matteo. Tom, I just want to give you the final word. You know, any final thoughts, especially about Coach Osborne in particular, and sort of your experience with him or his impact on you or anything like that?
Well, I think the Cornhusker fans are pretty smart about what the program has done over, the last 60 years, and Tom Osborne is a huge part of it, taking over for Bob Devaney, who I had the good fortune of playing 2 years for both of them, and they are as good a coaches as there has been in college football. And I think the Nebraska fans have been spoiled to have them part of it, and hopefully the appreciation for Coach Osborne, we definitely feel blessed to have him, be as valuable to us as he's been. And I just thank him for the time that he's spent and being able to play for him.
Amen to that. Great way to end it. Well, immense thanks to Mike Babcock and Brandon Vogel, and especially to Husker legend Tom Rood. Make sure you stick around. Next week, we will continue with the TO series, and we will be looking at the decade of the 80s, when the Huskers got tantalizingly close to a national championship, but didn't quite get over the hump in the entire decade. We will be back at you soon with that episode. Thanks again to our guests today. In the meantime, as always, GBR for life.
Done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. TNCs apply. Available in app only.